Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Kurt Marquardt. On behalf of the traditional coalition of the Historical and Systematics Department, and I have the honor to welcome you to this annual symposium, though not to the seminary. That will be done by the proper official. I shall not detain you long on isagogics, and not being the mayor of this pleasant town, I don't intend to welcome you to Fort Wayne, but I do merely want to draw your attention to the cultural diversity which has been contributed by this institution recently, and there's something new which wasn't here last year when you came. When you came last year, there was a very boring, to use the church growth phrase, homogeneity about when you went to certain establishments, they're all Don Halls. You know, the whole family and all Dons. Now, we have introduced some variety. We have now Augustine Hall and Ambrose Hall, and even, as someone said yesterday, Bugenhagen Hall. So, welcome to this new ecclesial surrounding. The task that I was given to perform in these few minutes was to present a sort of Ariadne's thread through the apparent labyrinth of our presentations. People ask, well, what is the basic overarching theme or scheme that holds these presentations together? And they do have a deep inner unity, which of course does not commit the lecturers to any particular details in their presentations. But what it has to do with is this complex and sensitive relation of the thought and theologies of Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon, a kind of yin and yang principle of the Church of the Augsburg Confession, which has often been oversimplified, and the Missouri Synod has not necessarily had a history of doing justice to Philip Melanchthon, to that part of it. On the other hand, serious questions now arise, because Philippism faces us in several new forms. And you know, Philippism has been disastrous to our church in two areas. In the area of soteriology, conversion, things like that, election, and in the area of the sacrament. So this concentration of that by which the church lives on the life-giving stream of salvation in the word and sacrament, that the Lutheran Church, unlike, for example, the Calvinist Church, lives from the Supper of our Lord. What is at stake here are not academic pedantries, but the survival of the confessional church of the Augsburg Confession. I shall not, of course, presume to take for granted or to anticipate the results of the presentations, and therefore I shall simply put in the form of two or three questions the kind of frame of reference within which our thinking here, it seems to me, perforce has to move. And one of the questions is this. If you take the Lutheran Melanchthon principle, so far as long as the two hold together, prior to Luther's death, all is well. There's a beautiful supplementation going on. When they begin to stand separately, does Melanchthonianism as such have, is it viable? Can it survive? What about the Lutheranism minus Philippism? Has it survival value? Can it stand independently? Further, when you see historically and theologically what happened with Philippism, is it in fact the case that Philippism has proved itself a kind of decompression chamber for Lutheran entry into Calvinism? And practical issues confront us on every side in all the ways which are to be addressed here. And how was it possible, for example, for a large Midwestern American Lutheran body to be rushed into church fellowship with the heirs of Calvin? How was it possible with so little resistance and at such breakneck speed? Is this connected to the Philippification of Lutheranism. I conclude. Someone has said, I read that recently with some surprise, that the Anglican Church, the mildest of all the Calvinist churches, is considered a Lutheranizing church, Ecclesia Lutheranizans. First of all, I think it's awfully pleasant to think that somebody in the world should be tempted to be Lutheran. That there is such a tendency. But be that as it may, within the Lutheran Church herself, there has been a strong Philippist tendency. And if, on the analogy of Lutheranizing, one may change that, the adjective, to a verb, if there has been a Philippizing, this observer closes his comment with the devout hope that a conference like this will give at least some measure of impetus to a strong Martinizing process for our church in these latter days. So, with that, I should like to introduce the president of the institution, who requires no introduction in this place, who perhaps on the continent might be called Professor Dr. Preuss, who will welcome you officially on behalf of the seminary and introduce our first speaker, Dr. Preuss.
The only use of the word Martinizing in town that I've met with is our local cleaner in town. The very stimulating number of questions, I don't know if they'll be answered or not. I've been talking recently about the Arminianization of Christianity in this country, even the Roman Catholics. Now I hear about the Philippization of the Lutheran Church, which I think has some deplorable credibility to it. And I just wonder if Philippization leads to Arminianization. Now, that's a very profound question, almost as profound as Professor Marquardt's. I want to welcome you here from a little different standpoint. You are welcomed as those who are interested in the Lutheran confessions and studying them, learning from them, recommitting yourself to them. I would like to welcome you here just as one who is president of a very good evangelical confessional Lutheran seminary, which appreciates deeply your interest in our program, and particularly your interest in this part of our program. Because if there's anything our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod needs today, it is to know what is Lutheran, and to make every effort to retain its identity. And certainly this seminary stands for exactly that same goal, which is the goal, if I get back to C.F.W. Walther and that book in honor of him, which he set as he established, you might say, a synod dedicated to confessional Lutheranism. We really appreciate having you here. I was over at the tea or whatever it was last night, the party for the alumni, and I noticed a whole bunch of St. Louis people and a few lay people, and please, you're always invited. Nobody is left out of anything. This is our 11th meeting like this. It was something that was concocted in the fertile mind of Dr. Scare, and I had something to do with it too. It's grown. This year, we think we can't really determine how many people are registered, but it looks like, whereas last year it hovered around 200, this year it's about 250. And so I think we may be growing geometrically, let's hope, from now on. There seems to be more and more interest in what we're doing. I have a couple of news items to give you before introducing our speaker. A society has been formed about 2 years ago called the International Foundation for Lutheran Confessional Research. It one day will be highly endowed. Today it is not, but it is active in doing a number of things. Specifically, two important, very, very important things, especially for people like you. First, they will be coming out with a quarterly bulletin, a modest thing, certainly at first, containing possibly announcements, book reviews, short analyses of issues of our day facing confessional Lutheran research and confessional Lutheran churches and theologians. I can't promise when it's going to be out. We wanted it to be out now, but it's been a difficulty getting editors overseas and contacts and so forth. You will certainly be sent a copy of this thing along with an awful lot of other people. The second project is much more ambitious. It is sponsoring this foundation, a dogmatics book. Again, we had hoped that we could have given you a date of the first volume or fascicle to come out. But once again, the authors are almost all of them full-time busy workers, and they just haven't been able to devote as much attention to their various volumes as they could. Essentially, it's a dogmatics book, of course, but it's one that will be written according to the thought pattern, theology, framework of the Lutheran creeds, of the ecumenical creeds, and the Lutheran confessions. This can't be done equally in every chapter or locus that's taken up, obviously, but it will be done as much as possible, and that will tend to unify the book. There will be 7 authors of the book, and I don't want to go into all of them. One of them just spoke to you, and one of them will speak to you in a few minutes, and one of them is speaking right now. At least you know who 3 of them are. I'll tell you who the rest are some other day. They are all men who have taught the Lutheran confessions, some of them for many, many, many years. They're all men who have written on the Lutheran confessions and on other theological dogmatic issues. It is not a substitute for Piper as a textbook. It is maybe a supplement of Piper, bringing him somewhat up to date as the Lutheran Church, bound to her confessions, seeks to speak to the world today and meet the issues, theological, ideological, sociological, and so forth. Look for that book. We'll be announcing it. It'll be coming out gradually as the different volumes are ready. And we think that it will be very challenging, every volume, and interesting to all of you. The last announcement is simply this, that our Board of Regents is meeting Friday and Saturday morning. I intend to bring before the board the motion, along with our academic dean, who is sponsoring this program, that we inaugurate here at the quickest opportunity a PhD program in systematic theology with special attention to the Lutheran confessions and to the creeds in general. This is a very new type of program. No school in the world has ever had this type of an academic doctor's degree. We think that with the help of the foundation, which I mentioned before, with the help of others who are possibly going to help us with endowment funds, possibly even an endowed chair, we can put this thing over. And who knows, some of you younger people who have gotten MSTs here or are studying at the SEM right now may one day be studying for a PhD in that area, at least, here at this seminary. We're very optimistic. Now, that's enough for the announcements, and now I wish to introduce our first speaker. I have known our first speaker for, I would say, about 27 years when he was called to the St. Louis Seminary to be professor in systematic theology, where I was professor, I think, about 2 years ahead of him, although he is quite a few years my senior. And I might say, my mentor in many ways. We grew very close to each other because of our mutual faith and also because of our great interest in Lutheran theology, the theology of our confessions. Dr. Richard Klann. He studied at Columbia University and various places like that, Union Seminary, but and he also studied under the redoubtable Paul Tillich. So I guess he's been exposed to the world a little bit. But his great achievement has simply been in the classroom teaching students for many, many years. He's a graduate of the St. Louis Seminary, but I'm very proud to say that he's a graduate also of our school. He was awarded an honorary doctor's degree last year. So without saying all about his accomplishments and talents, I wish to introduce Dr. Richard Klann, Professor Emeritus from St. Louis Seminary.
I think she deserves a comment. Thank you, President Price. I appreciate being here with you again. There are so many things that we have in common. And when this thing was assigned to me on December 15th, because of some kind of other impediment, I asked myself just what would be the context from which I would be speaking. And I remind myself that, like many of you here present, I began my introduction to the Confessions by means of the triglot in 1934. And I suppose I absorbed the enthusiasm of my teachers about the great reformers and never asked too many questions. I'm not so sure I read it as diligently, particularly in the historical introduction, as I ought to have, and as I've recommended to my students that they should. But I did have the opportunity of rereading things again and again. Then in 1960, I was given a year of absence and spent it in Heidelberg, Germany, among those named professors who participated in the Bekenntnisschrift and formulation, such as Heinrich Bornkamm and others that I heard. And this was also the year of the anniversary of Melanchthon, 1960. He died in 1560. And so there were a great many speeches and articles given. And occasionally I heard the Econiums, generously ladled out, particularly by Ernst Troeltsch, which I shall quote later on toward the end, about Philip Melanchthon. And you may see that this varied impression probably reproduced some of the emphases in this paper. The question is, was Melanchthon a Philippist on the doctrine of conversion? And of course, the topic requires interpretation. The term became a designation or name for a number of Melanchthon's prominent students and followers, particularly at the University of Wittenberg in Leipzig, during the decades after Luther's death, of course. As a group, they were known by the Orthodox or genuine Lutherans to be supporters of Melanchthon's deviations from the coherent divine monergism of Luther's teaching regarding free will, conversion, and good works. I'd like to add this qualification, perhaps. We talk about justification being the center of our doctrine, but according to Luther, actually, the center is God's monergism. He did it all from creation to the consummation. There is no exception whatsoever. And when he endowed the creature with gifts, they were his gifts, to be used according to his will, and to be abused according to the perversity of man. That's a very different picture than we find in Melanchthon. It is well known to students of the era that Melanchthon's theological formulations have been debated since the 1520s. Melanchthon was reported not to be happy about some of Luther's interpretations of the human condition in Luther's Bondage of the Will. But apart from Luther's criticism of Melanchthon's attempts to revise the Augsburg Confession, as is well known to you, especially the Variata of 1542, that his teaching on conversion became a serious issue, one place during their lifetime. Differences in their respective formulations appear to have been regarded as differences in emphasis only. And perhaps we might add colloquially, every time Melanchthon was attacked and Luther talked to him, Melanchthon succeeded in persuading Luther that he didn't really mean it that way. And Melanchthon was known to be very much interested in definitions and logical arrangements, syllogisms. And the truth depends upon how you defined it, he would say sometimes. And therefore, you had an obligation to be very exact according to his own standards. After the Emperor Charles V had defeated the coalition of Lutheran princes and issued his Augsburg Interim in 1548, Lutherans generally held the view that Melanchthon, who did vigorously oppose the Augsburg Interim, which provided for the reintroduction of or reimposition of Romanism in Reformation territories, that he, Melanchthon, would emerge as the heroic successor to Luther. But that expectation was not to be fulfilled. He was no Luther at all. The new elector of Saxony became much aware of the unrest in his own territories as well as in those of his neighbors. He enlisted Melanchthon for the project of a new interim, which political leaders hoped would avoid internal destabilization as well as new conflict with the emperor. Now, Melanchthon's willingness to take counsel of his fears regarding the survival of the Reformation, as well as his considerations for the safety of his own family and his own comfort. And this is well known, there's no mystery at all. It seems encouraged the disposition, or his disposition, to mediate opposing positions. The reopening of the Wittenberg University, which almost immediately after the conflict attracted about 2,000 students, and the generous arrangements provided for Philip Melanchthon by the new Saxon elector may have helped to bring about Melanchthon's participation in the formulation of the Leipzig Interim. But when the provisions of the Leipzig Interim were published in December 1548, a storm-like reaction by professors and pastors throughout Lutheran territories swiftly brought matters to the point of conflict and crisis. Many of the articulate Orthodox theologians offered their specific analyses of what the Leipzig Interim, approved by Melanchthon, meant for the churches of the Lutheran territories. Doctrinally and practically, the interests would have reversed the Reformation, not merely by the reimposition of the Roman liturgy and church order, but by the dilution of scriptural authority and by replacing the center of the Reformation, of Reformation thought, in favor of infused righteousness. Specifically, Orthodox Lutherans noted Melanchthon's silence on many doctrines which should have been confessed. Indirectly, the Leipzig Interim admitted the Roman teaching regarding original sin and free will. Now, how did Melanchthon's opponents interpret this action? That would be the next step. Apart from his well-known disposition to compromise doctrine by means of new definitions, they also sensed that his theological negotiations revealed signs of his anthropocentric turn of mind. And I'll have to talk about that a little bit later on. Named among the champions of genuine Lutheranism are Flacius, who left his position at Wittenberg University in 1549 for Magdeburg, a city where many others registered resistors of the interim found refuge, such as John Herman, Nicholas Amsdorf, John Wiegand, Matthias Judex, Alberus, Gallus, Westphal. They took the position shared by genuine Lutherans everywhere that the Leipzig interim, if accepted, would result in the destruction of the Reformation in Lutheran territories. Severe persecution of those who had opposed the Augsburg interim in South German territories had driven hundreds of evangelical pastors into exile. Schuckard says between 400 and 500 pastors were simply driven out from their parishes, thrown onto the street. Their families went begging almost, and some of them had to hide themselves, like John Brentz of Schwäbisch Hall. He had to find refuge in the barns of farmers for a time. It was a very difficult time of persecution for Lutherans. And you know, we have the same thing here we have in St. Louis. I had in St. Louis. I haven't been to many assemblies since then, since I retired. Every time the name Lutheran was raised, people started laughing. I don't think it's a laughing matter to be a Lutheran. These people paid for the name, although the name was given to them derisively. Luther didn't want it. But they paid a heavy price for it, and so did people since that time. We should be proud of the heritage. At least I personally am. My family has been Lutheran since the time that Bugenhagen reformed Pomerania about 450 years ago. And I don't believe that the blessings of God given to us in this way should be held in contempt of any kind. So much of my own comment, the reaction to that. Now, Melanchthon, the laity, however, I should say, stood very firmly against the interims, all of them, the reimposition of the Roman system. It's amazing how much they had learned since the visitation efforts of Luther and Melanchthon, reforming the congregations in Saxony and teaching the small and large catechism. Within a time of one and a half generation, perhaps, we had a very solid layer of Lutheran faithful people, or faithful Lutheran people. The leading Philippists were Camerarius II, that's the son of the older one who was at Augsburg, Major, Menius, Pfeffinger, Krutzinger, Strigel. Others who also were driven out of Wittenberg subsequent to the discovery of the Philippist conspiracy in Dresden in 1574, when a secret message was intercepted or misdirected and the whole plot was unveiled and the perpetrators tried to flee. You find that story partly told in Bente, page 189, but it's not the whole story, there's a lot more to it. They transferred to the Reformed churches. Again, this ties in with what one of our previous speakers has said. The Philippism was a bridge toward the Reformed churches at the time. They were convinced that their views were a proper bridge between Calvin and Luther, they said, toward the completion of the Reformation. And this development is strange indeed when considered in the light of Calvin's letter to Melanchthon of June 18, quoted also by Frank and Schlüsselburg, in which Calvin roundly denounced Melanchthon's participation in the Leipzig interim and admonishes him sharply for his lack of unflinching steadfastness and for his, quote, surrender of doctrine. Those are pretty strong words, weren't they? Now, Melanchthon was not an enemy of Calvin or vice versa, and to hear that would be like hearing Dr. Preuss telling me I'm a surrendering doctrine. I'm not steadfast. You can see the effect this had when this was published later on. There were other students and sometimes followers of Melanchthon who did not become Philippists, and preeminently among them we should mention Selnecker and Chemnitz. We think of these men as superior examples of confessional Lutheran orthodoxy. And furthermore, in a letter to Flacius, Melanchthon explained that his conduct is to be understood from his view of the interest of the church and of the promotion of the gospel. I wonder whether Melanchthon wrote as an administrator, such as we have nowadays. Another letter to Flacius, quite emotional in tone, offered a detailed accounting of his doctrinal and practical activities, and sharply rejects all false accusations, suspicions, and misrepresentation of Flacius and his supporters as detrimental to the gospel and to his office. Well, it's not new. We've been hearing that ever since. But all efforts at reconciliation failed. Flacius had demanded a public recantation of Melanchthon's public errors. According to Luther's Catechism, page 404, I guess it is, and you look at the newest edition. But attempts on the occasion of a meeting of the theologians to maneuver Melanchthon toward a confession of his errors, this happened after the Peace of Augsburg, when the emperor was chased out of the German territories into Italy, and princes were allowed to return to their Lutheran confessions. Then they had a meeting in Coswick, 1557, and the theologians tried to maneuver Melanchthon to the point where he would publicly admit his participation in this mess. But he would not commit himself. He would not make an admission of willful error or mistaken practice, although he did mention pressures by princes and jurists upon him. I imagine he is quite a model for those who imitate him now. The point to be made is this: Melanchthon consistently evaded or denied accusations of his contemporaries that he had modified or abandoned points of doctrine taught by Luther. And we need to inquire what elements of Melanchthon's teaching produced Philippists and disseminated his extraordinary influence among the leading men of his time. What created the institutions of learning for which he had been given credit and continued to influence the curricula of Protestant schools for about 150 years after his death? It is my conclusion, and I'm willing to be to stand corrected if it's wrong, that he was dualistic in his thinking. On the one hand, he considered himself a loyal and expert interpreter of the scriptures, which he affirmed to be the word of God. He would write pious sermons, pious articles. On the other hand, he was also a highly gifted linguist, a grammarian, Aristotelian scientist, and philosopher. At least he thought of himself that way. And all knowledge, he argued, represent a huge mountain which peaked in the final unity of all things, namely the knowledge of God. And he has quite a long statement on this in Corpus Reformatorum, volume 11, page 414. It would appear that it was indeed his program to teach Christian theology with the aid of his Aristotelian anthropology, coming at God through the understanding of man. Melanchthon, perhaps an imitation of Cicero, believed that man possesses a natural light of knowledge, I'm quoting him, whereby he could be sure of what he knew. And such knowledge is common to all men, he wrote, because the senses function similarly in human beings. Heat, cold, sound, weight, etc., are the same for all men. This led, if I understand him correctly, to his assumption of principia speculabilia. Now, what does this mean? It's a very ordinary and modern statement regarding presuppositions of thought. You must assume a lot before you can speak about something. But no one tells people, usually, that these are assumptions about which we're talking. Not evidence, not empirical or confirmed evidence, but assumptions, such as we have in Euclid's geometry. Not that Euclid is entirely wrong, that he's okay as far as he goes, scientists will tell me, or mathematicians, I should say, but they're far beyond Euclid. And this assumption leads ultimately to the presuppositions of the moral life. Notice, assumption leads to presuppositions regarding the moral life, which is ethics, based on the knowledge of good and evil. Again, Corpus Reformatorum, volume 13 and 21 have long disquisitions on it. Well, which way is he different from the modern utilitarian? Let's say from Dewey. That which works is okay. If you assume something and it works out for you, produces the work you have in mind, it's true. Well, in mechanics, it may be true. Is it true in theology and ethics and other areas? That's the question. The highest form of thinking, he wrote, was his ability to make definitions and distinctions as in syllogistic thinking. A very important position of his, sometimes ignored. I repeat, the highest form of thinking was the ability to make definitions and distinctions. Corpus Reformatorum, page 648. And such equipment must lead to a consciousness of God. An atheist, as far as he is concerned, is a conscious liar. He wrote that. Thus it's possible to argue from effect to cause, through which, by virtue of our innate consciousness, we discover God. Now, unfortunately, man's sin created conflicts between man's mind and heart, he said. So that the heart will now pursue aims which are contrary to the mind. And these are our innate judgments regarding good and evil. I'll spare you the references. This kind of thinking seems to be indebted to Paul's famous statement, Romans 7:15. For I do not what I want, but what I do the very thing I hate. Melanchthon appears to have used it to support his view that a true knowledge of divine order is implanted in man. I repeat, he seemed to think on the basis of that statement by Paul that a true knowledge of a divine order is implanted in man. At least remnants persist, he wrote in other places. Taking further steps in the development of his theme, he comes to the conclusion that, his naturalistic approach to the effect that man can know God. Revelation only adds to his natural knowledge. Melanchthon enlisted Plato's thinking to say that God is a spirit and the source of all that is good. But Plato's notion of God is not complete, he said. It is therefore necessary to study the Trinitarian revelation. Theology, when rooted in divine revelation, enlarges the knowledge of God offered in philosophy. And in this way, the gospel shapes the construction of Christian dogmatics. But since revelation does not share the philosopher's method of proof, because he always starts from experience in his formulation of principles, instead of trusting the assertions of revelation, theology and philosophy must be compartmentalized. They may not be mixed like broth in the kitchen, he wrote. But the theologian's inability to offer proof of the truth of the scriptures in terms acceptable to the methodology of the philosopher does not require him to abandon thought, which is a requirement for a rational presentation. Theology must be presented coherently, in continuity with all the works of God, so that man may increase in his knowledge. An illustration of the point is his treatment on natural law in the Slotsi Communis of 55. Let me read this. I don't think many of us have read this. Quote, many ask, what is natural law? The answer is that it is precisely the eternal, unchangeable wisdom of God, or in God, which he proclaimed in the Ten Commandments. However, we should understand this law as God himself clarified it through Christ, the prophets, and the apostles. God planted the glory of this, his own unchangeable wisdom, in men in the first creation. As the numbers 1, 2, 3, up to 10 are in us, so also is the light that God is an eternal, omnipotent, wise, true, good, righteous, and pure being, who created all things, who wills that all rational creatures be like him in virtue, and will punish and remove the rational creatures who are repugnant to his wisdom and righteousness. This is a legal understanding of the law, and it remains in man even after he sins. For God wants us to know his nature, and so in us the judgment against sin remains. The law remains. External civil life is to be regulated according to this natural light. And note well that this natural light and the Ten Commandments, when truly understood, are one single wisdom, doctrine, and law, unquote. But a modern logician, of course, would have serious difficulties with Melanchthon's argument of natural law as a natural light similar to mathematical relations, not to mention the Apostle Paul, who argued in Romans 1:18 following that men ought to know God by their natural light given to them in creation, but they have suppressed it. They have perverted it. It was the original gift, but it's no longer functioning. They have changed the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator. That's just the reverse of what Melanchthon was teaching. To be fair to Melanchthon, of course, we should say that he didn't stop here, but makes a leap beyond natural knowledge of God to point to, quote, the Spirit of God who sets everything in order. I don't think that's enough. He doesn't say enough here. An indication of changes in his teaching appear in his commentary, beginning with commentary of Romans, on Romans and of 1532. Here the natural light within man, understood as the activity of the Holy Spirit, is changed into six proofs of God. In his Loci of 1521, he disdained proofs of God. It's impossible, and so forth. He rejected Thomas Aquinas' attempt. But now he picks it up. He repeats this in his Loci Communis of 1535, in contrast to his, again, Loci of 1521, which disdained proofs of God. And his revision of the 1543-45 edition of his Loci increased the proofs of God to 9. Did he revisit Thomas Aquinas? The Luther student Hans Engelund has argued, and Melanchthon's student, I should say, has argued that Melanchthon's approach to theology through man, a return to tradition, raises the question whether this approach affected the article of justification, sanctification, the appropriation of salvation, and others. Did he open his thinking to synergism? Melanchthon was willing to work with a semi-Pelagian formula of facultas applicandi se ad gratiam. Man has the ability to apply himself to grace. He has a power, inherent power of his own, a spiritual power, which assists the Holy Spirit, in other words. to hear the word, to try to agree, and to end his sinning against conscience. And if you wish to pursue this, I urge you to read Corpus Reformatorum, volume 21, page 658 and the following. Frank, in his Theology of the Formula of Concord of 1858, reports that Melanchthon apparently was speaking of the will to the extent that God has healed it. But this is not quite so. It doesn't say that.